Where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 15th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Minnesota Congresswoman from the 5th District, Ilhan Omar will be joining us. We'll also be talking to David McMahon, a Local 52 Yahtzee member, on the looming 60,000 Yahtzee member strike, which could happen on Monday, effectively shutting down entertainment production. Also on the program, comedian Ben Gleeb will be here to talk to us about his debate with Charlie Kirk. Federal court reinstates the Texas abortion ban. Meanwhile, Manchin and Sinema begin to show how they want to decimate, specifically, the Democratic agenda. Biden administration plans large-scale wind farms across, I should say, along nearly the entire U.S. coastline. New Hampshire caves to anti-vaxxers and rejects $27 million in federal COVID assistance. Biden administration signals they are ready to reinstate the Trump Remain in Mexico policy under court order. However, it's conditioned on Mexico's agreement. John Deere forcing its white-collar employees to replace striking assembly line workers. January 6th commission will vote next week to hold Bannon in criminal contempt. An FDA panel gives preliminary approval for the Moderna booster vaccine. Lastly, Lebanon teeters on the brink of total collapse. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is what we call casual Friday around here, and I would like to say hello to whom I call Emma Vigeland.
I understand that's catching on. Yes, I know. Some people are starting to hear it in the street. Yep. Ah, is that who the person Sam calls Emma Vigeland? That is me.
That's it.
My identity is completely dependent on, you know, what you deem me as. Just continue. Keep going.
I picked up on what and just sort of like extended, you know, just everybody calling you Emma Vigeland. Yeah. So as you can see, folks, it is casual Friday. I am wearing a soft collared shirt.
But not for long. We're going to do a bit of a wardrobe change soon.
That's true. On the program today, we have an interview that we did yesterday with Congresswoman Omar, and so it's pre-recorded, and I did not. It was a Thursday. I could not wear the soft collar shirt when we recorded it. So,
yes,
that's just it's one of the contractual obligations I made to myself.
Yes, but you did shave, so
I did shave for the for the interview. That's correct.
Yes.
Consistency I was due. So yes, I am still shaven. Well, from yesterday. So, let's get to this. This is, sort of nuts. Well, sort of
pretty nuts.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. There has been in this country, I'm not sure if people are aware, a big attempt by the Republican Party and conservatives, and frankly, some I don't even know how to categorize these people, but like some a notion of some of these anti-establishmentarians complaining about the notion of critical race theory being taught in elementary schools or junior high schools or high schools. And to be clear, that's not happening. There may be sort of concepts that are downstream from critical race theory that are being taught in school. But basically the gist of critical race theory is that despite intentions, we have systems that are set up in this country. Theoretically, you could apply it to other countries too, if you wanted, that are racist in outcome and therefore are racist systems, even if the intent was not necessarily to discriminate based upon race. On this show that we have talked to many, many authors who have written books about this, whether it's about the tax code, whether it's about home ownership or wealth inequality or other issues. And I don't even know that we ever brought up the words critical race theory. But nevertheless, this has become a catch-all for making people aware that we have some racial problems in this country, and they're a legacy of racial problems in this country.
Yes.
And, of course, it's very hard to sort of thread this needle. How are you going to keep people from talking about the obvious racism that exists in our society? I mean, it does. How are you going to do that? Well, here is a leaked audio of a Southlake, Texas school administrator, a woman named Gina Petty. She's trying to explain the new Texas guidelines for school books, and not just for school books, but basically what teachers can teach in the classroom based upon the passage of a Texas law that was, you know, a means in which to prevent critical race theory from happening, or really basically to prevent teachers from feeling comfortable in discussing the fact that we have racist systems in this country.
And we should say that 4 days before this conversation was recorded, a teacher was sanctioned for having an anti-racism book in her classroom. So this is a part of a larger chilling effect brought about in this school district, Southlake.
And you'll hear the teachers, you know, talk about how they're afraid because they're being attacked. And they're not just being attacked like somebody wrote an op-ed. Like they're getting, you know, angry parents who have been don't like the idea that that their kids are being taught the idea that America has been, is, and can be racist. But here is this leaked audio. I think it demonstrates the one of the issues with this type of legislation.
We are in the middle of a political mess, and you are in the middle of a political mess. And so we just have to do the best that we can. And so we're going to go and you're going to do what you do best, and that's to teach kids.
I think we're all just really terrified.
I think you are terrified, and I wish I could take that away. I do. I can't. I can't do that. You are professionals. We hired you as professionals. We trust you with our children. So if you think the book is okay, then let's go with it. And whatever happens, we will fight it together. We will.
There's a lot of districts that are in the exact same spot we're in. And no one knows how to navigate these waters. I mean, no one.
Teachers complained they didn't get the new guidelines.
Room, just try to remember the concepts of 3979 and make sure that if you have a book on the Holocaust, that you have one that has opposing, that has other.
How do you oppose the Holocaust?
Believe me, that's come up.
So, number of the stars matches.
Number of the Stars by Lois Lowry there.
In a statement, a Carroll spokesman said that Petty's example about the Holocaust reflects the district's attempt to comply with the new state law that requires teachers to present multiple perspectives when discussing, quote, widely debated and currently controversial issues.
Like the Holocaust.
Like the existence of the Holocaust, apparently.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just this is naturally downstream from the critical race theory stuff where the project of the people funding this, like the Koch brother groups and the dark money AstroTurf campaign, is to engage conservatives on this like local level and get them involved. But really, this larger effort is in order to smooth out the historical replication of fascism and racism in general. And the Holocaust is an example of that, of course. In order to normalize current fascism and current racism. And so, like, we're acting like, oh, the anti-critical race theory stuff is separate from Holocaust denial. No, it's all a part of the same toxic effort by these groups.
Yeah. And we should also say, just got a IM saying that this school district in Southlake, right next to the Grapevine Colleyville School District, where the principal was fired for supposedly teaching critical race theories and, of course, posting a picture of him on his anniversary kissing his wife, who, while he was black, she is white. And so that also was like, why would you post that picture? And so he was being too controversial. That's what you got there. And that, of course, that audio was leaked and presented by NBC News. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota's 5th District. Right back after this. And this, of course, is a mention of one of our favorite sponsors. Here it is. I remembered the sign today. Sunset Lake Zebedee. Sunset Lake Zebedee is not only a purveyor of fine Zebedee products, things like the tincture with melatonin.
I have that right here.
That helps you sleep. Mm-hmm. They have fudge. They have coffee, gummies, smokables. Salve with Arnica. They have hand lotion. And all of their products are tested by third parties. And you can see what's actually in their products by going to their website, sunsetlakezebedee.com. And they also have great business practices. $15 minimum wage. Mostly employee-owned company. They are movement partners. Supporting strikes, supporting Afghan refugees, supporting local projects outside of Burlington where their farm is. They also practice really great agricultural practices that both protect the planet, that protects the soil. They practice regenerative farming, and they use integrated pest management, so they're not dumping chemicals into the ground or onto your products, and they use 100% organic fertilizer. So check it out. They have smokables. They have all sorts of things. Great products, great company. And the big thing is that they have a tremendous amount of return customers. And so that is their biggest calling card, aside from this one that I'm holding here in my hand. And this one says, use the code LEFTISBEST, one word, for 20% off. Left is best. 20% off. Check it out, folks. Also, you can get a subscription service and you get 25% off. So you get it automatically sent to you. But check it out. SunsetLakeZebedee.com. As always, appreciate both their product and their sponsorship. All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to play that interview that we recorded on Thursday with, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Minnesota's 5th District. Let's take that break and then roll that tape. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Congresswoman for Minnesota's 5th District and author of This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman, coming out in paperback shortly. Ilhan Omar, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the paperback. Let's start actually on the topic of refugees. We obviously have had over the course of really the past 3 or 4 months, I guess, two major, in terms of what garnered some news, issues with refugees. First, obviously, from Afghanistan. Do you have a sense of where we're at in terms of the Afghan refugees when it comes to paroling them? My understanding is you cannot apply for refugee status unless you're in the country. And there is simply not enough visas and perhaps maybe methods of giving visas to Afghan refugees to get them in the country so they can apply for refugee status. The Biden administration, my understanding is, could simply parole them and allow them to come in at least temporarily, then apply for the status. Do you know what the status of what's going on with that issue?
Yeah, so I think you've got a part of it right. So everyone who has entered the country has received humanitarian parole, which is what you were saying that the president has the authority to do. So everyone we've lifted from Afghanistan in that rescue effort, whether they have gone to the military bases here inside of our borders or they've been in other countries, have all received humanitarian parole. If they already didn't have a status established that would allow them to enter this country. And then from that humanitarian parole status that they have, means that the ones that qualify for refugee status, which is very different than, you know, when we talk about people fleeing and all of that stuff, we say these are refugees, but refugee is a actual category, which is why people often will say like Ilhan is a refugee in Congress, because there's a specific category that allows you to be under that refugee status. And majority of the people obviously don't have that status because they weren't processed as refugees. And so one of my colleagues from Massachusetts, Seth, I'm going to say his last name wrong.
Moulton,
thank you. he introduced legislation to make sure that refugee category could be applied to the Afghan refugees that were entering our country. And that came out of a conversation that we had in one of the security briefings that we got when we had the secretary come and talk to us. And so that bill eventually passes an amendment to the to an emergency supplemental that we did, the CR. And it is, I'm assuming now, the law of the land.
Okay, that's good. That's good to hear in terms of like getting some status, permanent, or at least some status and where it's settled, I guess.
Yeah, and the settlement of that status in itself allows for the folks who have come to our country or who would eventually come to our country from Afghanistan to actually receive the refugee resettlement support, because if you have only humanitarian parole or you enter as an asylum seeker, you don't have the infrastructure that folks who enter this country as a refugee to be resettled in the United States, like my family did. And that is really important for people who are starting from scratch and don't have family members here.
Let's talk about the what we saw recently in terms of the influx of Haitian migrants who did so in the wake of two massive disasters that were at least a function, at least in part, of a hurricane and an earthquake, and an assassination of the president in Haiti. This is on top of, I think, you know, our listeners, I think, are pretty familiar with the history of Haiti and America and intervention, et cetera. I'm curious as to your thoughts about, A, how the Biden administration is dealing with these Haitian migrants, and perhaps, you know, why? Like, why they are taking the tact on this that they are. I have some theories, but I'm curious as to yours.
You know, I mean, as you remember, Sam, when the president ran, he promised decency in dealing with people at our borders. He spoke about how he was appalled by the way in which the Trump administration was dealing with migrants who were showing up in distressful situations at our border. And, you know, in the most shameful way has continued to do the same thing instead of rolling back a lot of the policies of the Trump era. They're actually defending them in the courts and have in some cases actually expanded those. And so what we've been calling for the president to do is to provide humanitarian parole for Haitian migrants because of what you were just stating. These are people who are fleeing political stability. Many of them have transitioned through many different countries. And because of the hurricanes that continue to take place in Haiti and a lot of the economic devastations the country has gone through, many of these people obviously need our desperate help. You know, it's sad that an administration that has run to uphold international law is continuing to disregard the fact that people have an international right to seek asylum and they deserve to be dealt with in the most humane way. As someone who sought asylum in Kenya, a country that is much poorer than the United States, you know, the Kenyans recognized that I had an international right to seek asylum and help provide refuge for me and my family and, you know, hundreds of thousands of Somalis who were fleeing civil war and continue to do that as people come to their border. And so there's a lot of examples around the world, whether it is, you know, countries like Lebanon or Turkey or, you know, other countries like Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, who provide assistance to people that are coming to their borders seeking asylum. It's shameful that we live in the United States and, you know, have forced other countries to uphold international law and we're not willing to.
Well, I want to ask you specifically about the usage of Title 42 in this area, because we hear a lot of conservatives concerned about government overreach when it comes to COVID, if we're talking about mask mandates or vaccine mandates. But in my opinion, this usage of Title 42, carrying over the Biden administration, this Trump-era policy under the guise of pandemic response, I mean, it's clearly using the pandemic in order to circumvent traditional processes for asylum seekers. I mean, what is your stance specifically on Title 42 and the Biden administration's usage of it?
That's what I was talking about. I don't think that we should have Title 42. I don't think the administration should continue to defend it in the courts. It is one of the most abhorrent, you know, Trump era policies. It is not okay to use the pandemic to disregard people's international rights to seek asylum. You know, we're living under a pandemic that threatens the lives of everyone, regardless of what country you're born in, and to abuse folks who are actually being subjected to a political crisis, a humanitarian crisis, and desperately need our help to a policy that will victimize them more. It just seems really shameful and unjust.
Well, Congressman, let me ask you, why do you think the administration is pursuing this strategy, I guess? I mean, I understand the idea that maybe they're just simply afraid of this as a political issue. And you can tell me whether you agree or not with that idea. But speaking just specifically on the politics of it, do you get the sense that they're under the impression that it makes a difference what they do in terms of the way that it's going to be characterized by foes of immigration, by people who are inspired by racism, perhaps, to say that we shouldn't have Haitian immigrants in the country, or, I mean, whatever it is that inspires these people who have a problem with refugees or immigrants. I mean, what do you think their motivation is, and what do you think of even granting them that motivation, the way they're approaching this?
I mean, I don't think it's politically motivated, because in many ways I think it would be politically helpful to the administration to do away with Trump era policies, obviously, because there are so many people who had faith in them and elected them just because of that reason, right? That was the promise that was made. But I do think that secondarily, you know, we have to remember, right? There's just so many systems that have been broken, and the process in trying to stitch everything back together can take some time. And I do think in my conversations that there is a legitimate concern about the spread of the pandemic as we're seeing surges. And I believe that obviously that they have to work really hard and fast to address, you know, those concerns so that they can actually carry out a humane immigration policy.
So I'm sorry, just to clarify. So you think that this is they're buying time to rev up a sort of to fix the administrative state on some level, or is it that this is really more a function of how to reassemble a system that had been sort of, I think, deliberately targeted to be disassembled?
Yeah, I mean, I think the assembling of that system has been just a bit harder, I think, for the administration than they actually thought. I mean, if you think back to the promise that they made to increase the refugee resettlement numbers, and how they started out saying, "Oh, we're only going to do, you know, few." Right. We're going to do like 20,000. We're not going to do the 100 that we promised. And now we're realizing only, you know, a little over 7,000 has actually been resettled in the country. It does speak to the way in which these systems were dismantled. But I don't think that for us that care about having a just and humane system, those excuses of the system being broken should be enough. We should continue to urge, we should continue to speak with the rigor that we did with the last administration. We should continue to advocate for the humane system that we know that we can. We should also, you know, continue to fight the xenophobic tendencies that continue to show up whenever immigration is discussed. We have to remember that our country does both have a history of being a beacon of hope and welcoming immigrants at our border, but we also have a xenophobic history of turning people away. And even when they enter our country, treating them in a bigoted way. And so this sort of duality has always existed. And we certainly had the last president take advantage of that and dismantle the system in ways that it hasn't been dismantled before. And so there is, I think, a part of me that wants to understand that, to give this administration, you know, the acknowledgement that there is a lot of work to be done, but also remind them that promises need to be kept. And if people are told that you're going to be a more humane president and a more humane administration, then you need to do that.
I want to turn to your renewed calls along with a number of other lawmakers, including Representative Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others, to get the Biden administration to kind of pin down their response to student debt. They have said for months and months that they're looking into their administrative authority and their ability to cancel debt. But a lot of scholars have said that they essentially can cancel debt with the stroke of a pen via executive action. What are you urging for the Biden administration to do in this area?
Yeah, I mean, there was obviously a promise of a memo that is supposed to be released, giving guidelines on whether he does actually have the executive authority to do so. And the administration, every time we've asked for them to carry out their promise to help cancel student debt, have said, we're waiting for this memo to come out. We want to hear the advice of experts. I think Senator Warren and Senator Chuck Schumer have joined us in that effort of saying, we know you have the authority, you can do this. But since they keep hiding behind this memo, we're like, let's see what the memo actually says so that we can continue to engage in a conversation that is productive.
What's happening with this memo? I mean, are they making homemade parchment? Like, why is this supposed to be here in April? Like, is your sense that the memo they're not releasing? I mean, it seems to me if the memo says he doesn't have the authority, they would release the memo.
Yeah.
I mean, I
feel like you know something, Sam.
Well, I just know how long it takes to write a memo.
That is where we're at right now, right? We have made the asks. We've obviously introduced resolutions and all of these things. I didn't reintroduce my legislation to cancel student debt because we're all eagerly awaiting to hear this opinion in this memo. And so we want to know what the holdup is. Why doesn't the administration want to let us know what the memo actually says?
Do you think that they are waiting for the outcome of reconciliation of the Build Back Better? I mean, of the current sort of legislative dramas to resolve in some way before they start to deploy the unilateral authority that the president has in this area and in other areas? Or am I being a little, what is it, Pollyannish? Is that the right term? Like, am I being a little bit too optimistic about that, or do you think that's what's going on?
I do love your spirit in this. I can't speculate on what their the political strategy on this is. I hope you're right. I hope that they're willing to do this and actually just waiting for the right time to do it. Because whether it comes this month, next month, or end of the year, for the millions of people who desperately need this relief, it will still mean the same thing to them. I just actually believe that they are or were maybe hoping for a different kind of memo than the one that they have right now, and maybe they went back to the drawing board to try to find a different opinion.
A new memo.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you keep rewriting it, it's going to take a long time for it to happen. All right. Well, let's, speaking of memos and reconciliation, I think it was the Progressive Caucus released a memo in terms of what they're looking for from reconciliation. There were four principles that were outlined in that context. In short, correct me if I'm wrong. There is a call for shorter timeline on these programs so that they can be fully funded, but for a shorter period of time, essentially challenging a 2024 or 2025 Congress to not reauthorize it or to reauthorize it or the president, et cetera. Two would be quick deployment so that there is presumably some political benefit. And so the people understand what's happening. There was a lot of talk about how long it took the ACA to deliver to the extent that it delivered benefits for people. It took a long time for that to happen. Three, that they be universal, which I take to mean no means testing. And four, that the commitment to racial equality within the Build Back Better bill be maintained. Is that essentially what the Progressive Caucus is looking for? And if so, how do they leverage, to the extent that they have any power, how do they leverage to make sure that that happens?
Yeah, I mean, we have had the votes, right, to deliver a full agenda out of the House. You know, we obviously have been running a tight ship in the Progressive Caucus to try to make sure that, you know, we count the votes in a way that is productive for us to engage in actual negotiations. And so we know that there is no piece of legislation that can pass the House without having, you know, our priorities and without, like, fulfilling the four points that you had just outlined. We've always maintained, right, the top line number that we are negotiating is based on our priorities being funded. And now if the top line number needs to change, we still want these priorities to be funded. We can live with them being funded a shorter period of time.
Do you think that there was a strategic error made in so much focus on the top line number? I mean, my understanding is, I mean, it's been reported that Chuck Schumer was aware that Joe Manchin had a different top line number 4 months ago in July. But yet, let me ask you this. Were you made aware of that number? Do you know whether members of in the House were made aware that Joe Manchin had a number? Because it seems like maybe the idea at that point is to not necessarily tout the 3.5 if there's an awareness that somebody has a different number and that person is, you know, the baby president on some level or something. How much awareness was there in the House of Joe Manchin's number?
I think outside of what we've read in the news, I don't think there was an awareness. And we were all working out of the assumption that this was agreed upon number because, as you recall, the budget resolution itself had to be passed out of the Senate to be sent to us so that we can mark up the bill and, you know, formulate it to have the actual policies in them. And so I still don't understand how Manchin and Sinema decided that they were going to vote yes on a budget resolution with a $3.5 trillion. And then months later, after we've all been working, are just like, oh, I didn't really realize that that is the number I kind of was agreeing to. And that, you know, all the work that you were going to do was going to mean nothing. And I still don't know what number I want and what policies I actually agree with. I mean, Manchin is still willing to have a conversation about policy. We haven't heard much from Sinema, so it's hard to have a conversation with people who sort of flip-flop all the time.
Well, she said she'll only negotiate with the White House, right? So, I mean, how is that? How does the sausage get made if you're unsure of what ingredients are going into said sausage by Chef Sinema? I mean, it makes your job quite difficult.
I mean, it's also really interesting, right? If we're going with a chef situation where your negotiations aren't happening with your co-chefs in the kitchen, but you're somehow negotiating with you know, the people who are coming to eat the food. You know, I just don't recognize or refuse to recognize someone who doesn't want to negotiate with the actual legislators, but wants to negotiate with the administration that's not one voting on the bill or writing the bill.
Stepping outside the restaurant metaphor for a moment.
I don't think we did it very well.
It's my fault from the outset.
Do you have like a, I mean, I think Manchin has shown, at least it appears from, you know, the shadows of this stuff that we see, that there's at least some a willingness to negotiate, and we've just gone through the whole chef metaphor to explain that's not necessarily the case with Senator Sinema. Do you have a message? What would be your message to Senator Sinema at this point? I think she's in Europe at this moment, fundraising, as far as I know from the reporting. But in the event that she happens to tune in to the program today, what would be your message to her?
Nothing. I think she's heard enough from her constituents and the people that she's actually supposed to represent. If that hasn't been enough for her, I don't know what I can say to her.
Do you worry that the moderates who have been slow walking the Build Back Better bill, that the so-called moderates, I guess, that the that people like Sinema and Manchin are going to undercut enthusiasm when we get to the midterm elections?
I don't think so. I think if we are able to deliver and get them on board to fulfill the promises that we've made to our collective constituents, I think that that's going to be enough. I think to most people, what somebody else does is quite irrelevant than what their representative is doing. And I think that there is a lot of us who have been both on the moderate and progressive side, outside of the few conservative Democrats that we have, that have actually shown that Democrats don't just say they are the party of the people, but for the first time are willing to fight for the people.
Do you feel the weight of that responsibility in the CPC? Because it's really kind of a bit of a new dawn for the way that the Congressional Progressive Caucus is wielding its power. I mean, the fate of this massive agenda is really with progressives in the CPC holding the line under Pramila Jayapal's leadership, where I feel like the muscle has been flexed a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, interesting to be the caucus that has been disregarded by Democrats for the most part to now be the caucus that is saving the agenda of the Democratic president and the agenda of a Democratic speaker and a Democratic majority leader. It's a bit strange, but we proudly carry it because this is an agenda that we collectively believe in. It's an agenda that the Progressive Caucus and our base has been pushing for and has been asking for a really long time. It obviously doesn't go as far as we all want it to be, but it gets us closer to that goalpost.
Well, I mean, talk a little bit about the dynamics that have changed in that regard, because I think we spoke to Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez about a year ago, I think it was. I can't really remember, but I think it was probably about a year ago. She had at that point was talking about reforms that. That you were looking for. By you, I mean, I think the members of the squad, the fellow progressives within the Progressive Caucus, to make the Progressive Caucus actually progressive. And both in terms of like trying to define what that meant and not allowing the Progressive Caucus to simply be like a good housekeeping stamp of approval, but it actually required some components to it, but also, you know, how to wield power in the first part. Is there any, I mean, when someone now signs up to be a member of the Progressive Caucus, is there any talk within the caucus of saying you can sign up to be, you don't just get to choose the title? There are certain litmus tests that we have in terms of positions. Is that in the works in some way? I mean, I think it's impressive that we had 50, you know, to the extent that we knew the exact number. By we, I mean us, not you. To the extent that we knew the real number,
or at least that we knew the number that was being communicated, it was, you know, over 50, but there's over 100 members of the Progressive Caucus. So what of those other 50 or 40 or 30, whatever that number is, is there a desire within the caucus to make the caucus maybe not as big, but as more cohesive?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we came into Congress, a lot of us were proposing, you know, different kind of reforms that should be made. There were some that were proposing what you're suggesting, of making it smaller and more cohesive. And some of us, including myself, thought, you know, we could keep whatever number that's out there with actual guidelines like other ideological caucuses have of what makes you a member of the Progressive Caucus. How often do you need to vote with us in order for you to maintain your status within the caucus? What policies do you have to agree to support in order for you to have membership? And, you know, whether you are endorsed or not, when you come into Congress, can you join without going through a screening and an approval process? And so the changes that we've made are along the lines of what I just said. You know, there is a certain percentage of votes that you have to take with us. Only if we are if we have whipped on that vote, right? Like majority of the votes that we take are not things that the Progressive Caucus or any ideological caucus is whipping on, or even just the whole caucus is whipping on. They're just given majority of the stuff that we take, majority of the votes that we take. But for the ones that are of value, if we whip on a vote and we decide that we're voting a yes or a no, there is a certain percentage that you have to be voting with us in order to have a good standing with the caucus. There's obviously, you know, all of these bills that you have to agree to support in order to be part of the caucus. There's a certain number of meetings that you have to come to every month. There is a strategy that you have to support that's put forth by the caucus. And it drastically has shifted the cohesive ways in which we work together. You know, I was the whip my first term last cycle, and it was a really painful process, I'll tell you. I really was confused about why some people were progressive or were in the Progressive Caucus and how we could justify their membership, and the lack of accountability was bizarre to me. I used to be the assistant minority leader when I was in the Minnesota House, and there was some accountability, and there, you know, there's just no accountability. And so once we've made the changes, obviously there is a higher turnout to the meeting. So everybody, you know, can be part of the debate. We can make decisions together. There's a faster response to my whip efforts. There is a cohesive way in which, you know, our deputy Katie Porter, our chairwoman Chayapal, and myself work together in our teams. So it's just it's a very much more effective caucus. You know, my whip deputies and their staff are excellent. We just do things differently, and it shows.
Just wrapping up here.
I will say the number was more than 50.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm going to assume you're not going to tell me what that percentage is either. But all right. So with that said, I mean, just lastly, you know, what has been the reaction in the larger Democratic caucus to this shift? I mean, because this feels like the first indication. It's really the first opportunity, probably too, in many respects, for this sort of revamped Progressive Caucus to emerge. What do you anticipate will be the implications of this, and what was the reaction to this? I mean, because we should just say that it's ironic that there's that many members of the Progressive Caucus who wanted that moniker, but yet this is a caucus that has been, and the caucus has allowed it, completely ignored, in the context of legislating. This, in my recollection, that, you know, goes back a couple of decades, is the first time that I've seen like this type of situation where the people who wanted that, you know, wanted to break the deal about the bipartisan bill lost, and or at least have lost up to this point. What was the reactions, and what do you think the implications are going to be going forward?
I mean, I think the reaction has been quite positive, because in many ways, outside of, you know, this cohesive nibble strategy that the Progressive Caucus has carried out, part of our strategy has also been to do outreach to other ideological caucuses about the bills that we support, and why we think that it would be beneficial for them to be on board with us. And so, you know, with the help of people like Katie Porter, who's a frontliner, but a progressive, and a bold progressive, because she understands how to communicate some of these policies to her district, she's able to maintain her progressive status, and you know, still represent this district that is a swing district. And we've been able to gain the support of so many others that are not part of our caucus to be, you know, with us in the strategy that we have developed in regards to the reconciliation piece. And she's also encouraged other frontline members that are part of the Progressive Caucus to be in the forefront of this advocacy work that we do within the larger caucus. We've also had, you know, frank conversations with different chairs and others who are in leadership, who, you know, sometimes used to have tensions around their leadership positions and being, you know, in support of the Progressive Caucus's policies and point of views when it came to negotiating. And so now we sort of have our chairs that are part of the Progressive Caucus, people who are in leadership fighting for these progressive values in these rooms. And so it's not just the chairwoman or the deputy or me and others that are part of the executive team.
That's interesting. And I imagine part of that outreach also involves some fundraising as well.
Sure.
Okay.
That is, I think, part of politics. You can't do anything without it. And, you know, majority of us, even you know, a lot of the chairs and others are starting to rely on grassroots fundraising, which means, you know, that there is a lot of that outside inside strategy that we can continue to deploy, and people can understand how meaningful it is for them and how much it takes away their anxiety of trying to appease, you know, special interest groups, because there's less anxiety when you're appeasing your constituency and the people that have honored you to be their voice in Congress than, you know, when you're trying to appease special interest groups and lobbyists. There's something a little icky about that.
And the squad's ability to do that kind of fundraising in mass is probably, you know, makes them take you a little more seriously, I'd imagine.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think there's people outside of this squad, like Katie Porter and others, who have found a lot more success than, you know, someone like myself have. There are different efforts that people put into fundraising, and a lot of people spend a lot of money to raise money, and you know, it shows, and I think it's giving other members who are hesitant about that, who hate the fact that they spend so much time on the phones, an incentive to engage with with the base and do more of a grassroots work than be stuck in dark rooms making deals that nobody really in their constituency benefits from.
Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Back. And that is our interview with Congresswoman Omar. And, you know, and before we go, I should just say later in this program, we're going to have David McMahon. He is a Yahtzee member from Local 52. And Faye Weitschel, she's an Yahtzee member from Local 600, talk about the potential strike that could happen on Monday and shut down entertainment programming. We're also going to be talking to Ben Glebe, who had a very funny debate with Charlie Kirk. But before we sign off for our Peacock viewers, what I thought was really interesting, Emma, and everybody else, I guess, should be fair. What I thought was very interesting about what she had to say there is it really sounds like, in terms of the flexing of the Progressive Caucus power, they also seem to be playing, not just using their power, but they're also using, you know, there's a carrot and stick approach here. And when they're not saying, essentially breaking the backs of moderates when it comes to like this last vote situation with the reconciliation and the bipartisan deal, they're going out there and they're providing, like, you know, some benefit. They're building bridges. And, right. And to be clear, I've said this for years. The reason why Steny Hoyer, as a whip for the Democrats, was so effective is because he gets so many corporate donations in his home state that he can afford to go around and help other people raise money.
And it's a big reason why Hakeem Jeffries is likely the next in line to replace Nancy Pelosi as well, in a very similar position as Crowley was, who Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ousted. They have a major fundraising apparatus, so leadership takes them seriously. So
and it's not just a question of leadership taking them seriously. They can go around and provide material benefit.
Yes,
to
they can help
other,
them out.
Their
right.
colleagues, and they build a bank of favors. And this is now, this era is the first time where progressives have the ability to raise that kind of money as well. Mm-hmm. And then sort of like do that same thing, create a bank of favors, because that's the way these things get done. I found that really interesting. Hopefully we can have her back on in the future and talk, you know, talk more about what the Progressive Caucus as a caucus is doing to build their power and how they're intending to leverage it at different points. But I thought that was interesting. We should say to our Peacock viewers, we will see you on Monday. Thanks for joining us.
Goodbye.
And for the rest of you, stick around. In fact, let's just bring on right now David and Faye. Do we have both?
Yep. All right, we're bringing them on now.
Okay, great. Okay, so David and Faye, welcome. I don't think you guys know each other, you two, let's start with you, David. You're from Local 52. My understanding, Local 52 is the folks who do all the mechanics, like the grip, the gaffer, props, craft services, etc. Tell me more about, and then the relationship that you have to Yahtzee.
Okay. Yeah. Local 52 is based in New York. Then we have a few other regions, you know, the rest of New York State, part of Connecticut. And I'm in Philadelphia region, Philadelphia, South Jersey, Northern Delaware. So the studio mechanics, basically we create everything that you see there. You know, we build the scenery, we set it up. We go to locations, alter as needed, make safe as needed. You know, so that's lighting, rigging. I'm in set construction. I build scenery. We have, you know, scenics who are not 52, but related, but also IA, who you know, everything that you see on camera. Oftentimes, you're not even aware that it's actually built scenery. But most of what you're seeing there, in some way, has been touched. Well, it all has been, because it's been, you know, it's been lit at least, right? So it's that everything that you see, the visual picture that you see as the component, we have put that in front of the cameras.
And Faye, what does members of Local 600 do?
So members of Local 600 covers the camera department and the unit publicist. And within the camera department, that'll cover the director of photography, the camera operators, city cam operators, first ACs, also known as focus pullers, second ACs, digital imaging technicians, also known as DIT, and film loaders or digital utilities.
Yeah, people don't realize how many people it takes to operate a 35-millimeter camera. It is pretty impressive. There's about, I don't know, 8 people hovering around the camera as it, and then I imagine, David, I believe folks from 52 would be the one who are putting down the dolly tracks, or is that also in the camera?
It is the grip department, but there are shooting grips. There are different categories of grips, but there are shooting grips who actually will do dolly track and things like that. And Faye, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right.
Yeah. So I'm in more of the construction end. And again, that was a choice on my part, because for a period of time, I was a single parent and I could not do the type of scheduling hours that shooting crew has. So being in the construction department within the, you know, within the industry, we at least have the most predictable schedules of most departments.
Well, yeah, then talk about your schedule then relative to those other backbreaking schedules there, right? I mean, like, what are some of the conditions that all of you are faced with as members of the crew?
Well, I mean, actually, you can go first, Faye, because you actually are there. The closer you get to the camera, the more the chaos is. So go for it.
Yeah. So it's if you're full time on a show, that would be generally shooting 5 days a week. The schedule could be Tuesday to Saturday. It could be, you know, it's not necessarily Monday through Friday, but generally 5 days a week. And if you're shooting, let's say, a broadcast, you know, I'll take example. I was on Person of Interest. It was not uncommon for us to, on Monday, start at 5 a.m. or so. And then you shoot 12, 13 hours. You know, your schedule keeps shifting throughout the day. So Tuesday, your call time might be 10 a.m. Wednesday, it's noon. Thursday, it's 1 p.m. And then, you know, you can get to Friday and it's 2, 3, 4 p.m., you're working until 5 in the morning. I've had 5 p.m. calls on Fridays, not on Person of Interest, but on other shows. Mm-hmm. And then you shoot, you know, 12 hours, 13 hours, whatever. There's been jobs where I get in a cab to go home at 10 a.m. and we started on Friday. And then it's rinse repeat the next week. So the weekend is just, yeah, you have time off, but either you're sleeping and getting yourself recuperated / just doing laundry or basic adult things, because, like, you can't go to the grocery store while you're shooting. There's just not enough time in the day. And then it's rinse repeat, and you do that for 6 to 9 months. Maybe you take hiatus, maybe you do movies in between. And, you know, if they're indie movies, sometimes the schedule can be even more brutal.
And we should say, Faye, the reason why it progresses through the week is often a function of there is a provision that the union has got, that you can't have a forced turnaround within a certain period of hours. Although sometimes that gets broken. I mean, my understanding is, David, let's talk about what we're talking about. I mean, obviously we've just heard Faye, recount the excessive hours, and studios will do, or producers will do, will sometimes they'll pay the fee, the extra fee, if they have to extend the hours of people who are on the set, let's say, or maybe in a studio. But what are the major issues, and are they different, David, from your perspective in terms of, like, what impacts your work as much? And then Faye, you'll tell us what impacts your work. But David, why don't you start with what are the major issues that Yahtzee is, I mean, and we should say, It's like 99% of the members of this union authorized a strike. I mean, that is, I don't know if it's unprecedented, but that's got to be up there.
Sure. Well, it's up there considering you're also talking about, you know, close to 60,000 people who took part in that vote, 50 some thousand people, and you have that high percentage. But I will say, you know, just first off, we are all in this together. So there's that. So the working conditions, the wages, how our benefits will be funded, you know, there's the new media component to all this. And basically, you know, this is all the basic stuff. I even stay away from some of like the big projects like the Marvel films and stuff like that, because even from the construction standpoint, those things are like mass human sacrifices. I steer clear of them as much as possible. It's like you sign up for a job like that, and you're just like the din, the noise, the pressure of people constantly around you, and this goes on for months on one of those really big things. It's like, you know, I heard something on NPR the other day. Well, you all don't work in a coal mine, whatever. But I tell you, when you work on one of these things, you know, and you're full on, and they're like a little bit behind schedule, or you know, they haven't planned very well, which is something that's been reduced. Production planning has been reduced over the years that I've been in the business. So we're just kind of fighting for really basic things. And a new thing that rolled in through the pandemic is now the concept of the rolling lunch. We all don't break and sit down and have lunch together at the same time. You know, that was kind of a COVID-based safety measure, but now it's morphed into this rolling lunch where you get, you know, you grab something to eat at your workstation or whatever. You know, so they will take advantage of these opportunities however they come up. But the biggest thing is, you know, we have to have proper funding of our benefits through new media. We have to have a better wage structure, especially for the lowest paid, and just my own personal, you know, position, you know, production assistants who are not organized, we should have this opportunity here to organize them in as well.
Faye, speak to this, but I just want to make it clear to everyone. We talk about new media. We're not talking, I mean, like, you know, there was a time, there's always a new media, and it's certainly been that way for the past like 30 years, right? I mean, first it was just broadcast, then it was cable, and because we don't get the same you know, back end sales on cable, we need a reduction on that, and then et cetera, et cetera. The fact of the matter is that Apple, Netflix, Amazon, the idea that these guys are new media, the implication used to be like, if you're doing new media, you don't have the same profit margins. You don't have the same budgets. You don't have the same money. The idea that Apple, Amazon, and Netflix don't have the money to put into pensions at the beginning, because their model is completely different than it was, you know, 20 years ago with I guess 25, 30 years ago when it was like five or six networks. And they're trying to basically undercut the funding of these pensions by pretending they're some type of different animal and they need some type of like, you know, help in launching, essentially. So, Faye, speak to that a little bit, but also from your perspective, I would imagine hours are a huge part of this. I mean, it's getting brutal. And of course, Netflix, again, They're going out and they're doing orders of like eight or nine, as opposed to the way it used to be, where you would get, you know, maybe a full season or two or something like that. And they have enough money that it's worth it to pay the penalties. But the problem is, like, you still got to eat. Like, it doesn't, you know, the extra couple of bucks you get, all right, great, but you got to eat. The penalty is there to disincentivize them from taking away your lunch break. But it's not disincentivizing them anymore. It's like it's like somebody with a billionaire with their Maserati. Like, they don't care about a speeding ticket. They're just going to drive. But speak from your perspective on those issues.
Yeah. So exactly what you were saying, new media was originally designed for, like, you know, small web series, the same way we have low budget, contracts for small independent films so that they can be union. You know, that's how I got my career start, was working on a lot of low budget indie films. And that was the idea for the new media contracts. And it was never designed for, you know, these massive companies like Amazon or whatever to get these breaks. You know, they can afford to pay the same rates that NBC, ABC pays for their broadcast and cable. And they're, you know, like you were saying, into paying our pensions. Originally, our pensions were funded through the residuals on, like, DVD sales. Well, that is not the case anymore. You know, businesses change. And now they're saying we don't have any right to the residuals from the streaming platform, which is obviously ridiculous. You know, if it wasn't for us, none of that stuff would exist in the first place. But also, yeah, there were promises made to us by producers when we came back from the pandemic that we would be shooting, you know, 10 hours because epidemiologists said after 10 hours, your body can't fight off infection. This is all before vaccines and everything. And then about a month into shooting, that went out the window, back to 12, 14 hour days, back to no meal breaks. And, you know, for speaking of someone in the camera department, if we're not working, then the production's not happening. We can't take breaks. There's no one to, you know, if I'm pulling focus on a shot, there's no one to jump in and take that over. If it's not me, there's no one else. We're not like seated deep, you know,
right.
There's one focus puller for each camera. There's one camera operator. I've been on plenty of shoots where, you know, we have to wait for the camera operator who went to the bathroom and like everyone's upset that we're waiting for them to come to the bath back from the bathroom. These rolling meals, you know, it's not just 10 hours with no breaks. It's 14 hours with no breaks, you know, and for the camera operators, Steadicam, they're holding these 60 pound cameras. I'm frankly worried about their spines. You know, how long of a career are they going to have?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Demma.
Yeah. You touched on it a little, but I just am curious. This is kind of a big picture conversation about how the pandemic affected everybody's relationship with their work and how that kind of maybe got all of you to see the value of what you were doing and how things were getting extreme in terms of the mistreatment and exploitation. Did that spur everybody into action in a different way than before the pandemic happened?
I don't think it was consciously that, but the fact that people did kind of like get a moment to step back and take a deep breath and kind of see like what they've just been through, you know, and then compare that with, you know, even though it was in very fraught times, you know, it was like you still have that moment to potentially, you know, be at home, to be with your kids, whatever it might be. And then going back into it, you know, relatively early on, you know, like, so again, this is all still pre-vaccine, which is, you know, we had testing, we had safety protocols, all that sort of thing. We had different levels of safety protocols, depending on how close you got to the talent, you know? But again, like as Faye was saying, and then it just kind of crept in, you know, the urgency, the pressure, the speeding up the conveyor belt, you know, it all slowly crept back in. And at that point, people were just like, look, you know what? This is entertainment. We're actually not essential.
Right, right. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are in your industry, both, you know, what they call above the line, in terms of like actors and producers, but also a lot of production people. And just to be clear, Faye, we're only talking here, not only, but we're talking about movies and television. We're not talking about commercials, correct?
Correct. The commercials are not under the same basic agreement. And also independent films and HBO are not under the basic agreement.
And are there unions? I was speaking to someone who is a production designer. And I didn't have time to follow up on this, but are there unions that have a different strike authorization date, and if you're aware of, and are there unions who are saying we're not going to cross the picket line? I mean, it's not like, I mean, this is, we, to be clear here, we're watching what's happening with John Deere. They're taking some of the white collar workers and they're putting them, they're forcing them to get on the lines. That's not going to happen here. There's no executive from Netflix, with all due respect to Ted Sarandos, and there's nobody who's going to go like, we're going to rack camera, or I'm going to build a set. That's not happening. This is going to shut down. But are there other unions who are going to say like, we're also not going to, you know, I don't know if that's like post-production houses or something like that. Are there other unions that are going to they're going to stop the stuff that's in the can? Are there other unions that are going to step up and say, like, we're not even going to produce this stuff in the can?
Yeah, there's a bunch of unions that have joined us. And I do want to point out that the basic agreement is about the Hollywood 13 locals. And one of those is Local 700, which is the Editors Guild. So that does hit post, you know, obviously immediately. But, you know, DGA has said they're going to stand with us. The Writers Guild, both East and West. DGA, frankly, also one of the most important ones is the Teamsters have said they were going to join us. No gear is getting anywhere unless the Teamsters are willing to drive it. So that just, you know, kind of nail in the coffin as far as that goes.
All right, is there anything, David Fay, that we can tell, point our listeners to that you guys think it's important for them to see or to support the folks in Yahtzee? I know that there's an Instagram account that details the working conditions that folks have endured. Is there anything else?
I would just say, I mean, you know, depending on with level of support they want to give, you know, they can go to the International's website. It's IATSE.net. And, you know, information's posted. There's ways to support are posted on there. There's kind of a toolkit, you know, of, you know, if you want to, you know, post information. Or we did get a lot of support from Congress people. So that aspect of it went together. We got a lot of, you know, we got letters of support from those folks. But again, like the IA stories on Instagram is a huge one. And, you know, I don't know that there'll be any kind of, you know, boycotting or anything of that. But again, just make sure that it's coming from the workers and the union, and it's not like a third party kind of initiative and stuff like that, because those aren't going to really make the point.
Faye, David, thank you both for coming on, and good luck. I hope the producers, this is the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, come to their senses. But they're facing a lot of solidarity, and I think so I wish both of you luck, and thanks so much for coming on.
Could I just say one thing? I'm sure. Such a huge fan. It's crazy that I'm on this right now. I've been following you guys. I've been following you guys since like 2015, you know, and you have been so you have been, as old as I am, you have helped in my recent formation. So there you go. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Really much
appreciate it. Thanks for having us on.
All right. Thanks. Thanks so much for coming on. All right, folks, we will put that link to the Instagram account in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. All right, let's just keep going. We don't need to take a break.
Well, you might need to just push your hair down a little bit.
I know. I'm getting a little sweaty over here. All right, so wait, do we have Ben?
Yeah, we're marathoning this.
Yeah. Ben Glebe is here, and this is well. Let's wait for Ben to come on. Ben is a comedian, an actor, writer, right? Ben,
correct.
And and now a slayer of Charlie Kirk. But you know, I got to say this. I remember seeing your stuff on the College Network in like early aughts. I did a lot of work with the guys who started Burly Bear and Broadway Video at that time, you know, back in the 90s. And, you know, 2003, 2004, I was still sort of in the comedy world. And so I was watching this stuff. And I remember you, like, I was reading it, and I'm like, yes, that's where I remember seeing you from. But
National Lampoon Network back in the day took over for Burly Bear and Broadway.
Exactly. And so it's funny to see you now. We're many years later. Well, let's just start with this. How did you end up debating Charlie Kirk?
In all the years since my National Lampoon days, I've gone on to do a lot of things, kind of in a mixed splinter direction in my life, maybe one that I should choose a lane that would help me progress faster in my career. But part of it is very fun, light entertainment, like being on Chelsea Lately for years and hosting my game show Idiot Test. And then part of it has been a bit of political punditry and trying to hold some of these jerks to account that try to have opinions that advance themselves while keeping other people down that just don't seem to have humanity as any part of it. And so I've done a lot of that. I used to be a CNN correspondent. I've been co-host on The Young Turks. I was on NPR, on a comedic show on NPR, doing political commentary for 7 years. And I even ran for president in the 2020 election. I don't know if you know it, because a lot of the more fringe campaigns were just not given any airtime, but we broke through a bit. We ended up as the 15th highest fundraising Democratic campaign when the campaign ended. So I have some political bona fides, and I speak out all the time. And I think Charlie Kirk probably knew a little bit of that, but also maybe thought he had an easy target debating a comedian. And that didn't work out too well for him.
No, it didn't. Now, we played the moment that went really viral. We played that the other day just to, drive people to see the full debate. But that's when you pulled out a picture of a photograph. I guess maybe it was a photocopy of a photograph. And it was a picture of a fetus. And you said to Charlie, do you really think this is a person, a human being? And he said, yes, I do. And you said,
without a doubt.
And then it turned out to be a dolphin that he was looking at, a dolphin fetus, we should say.
That's correct. You definitely played it, because in the comments, your people are calling me Dolphin King. So they've
there
definitely
you are. There you are.
Yeah, then we've had Tiger King, and now we have Dolphin King.
My favorite part was when he said after that, like, you mislabeled it. And he just, I think, was so sort of embarrassed that he couldn't really get the fact that that at that stage of development, we are not talking about a person. I mean, it is, I am of the mind that it is life, but so isn't a plant. I mean, let's be honest, the tree is life, and an embryo is life. Although it is not, I mean, it is so dependent on its host. But, you know, viruses are dependent on their host too. And that is, there's life there too.
Yeah, but no one's against killing viruses, for the record.
That is true. And so it was a fascinating exchange. I want to play a couple of clips.
Sure.
And just, like, I don't know, get your take on what was going on there. And I liked how it started getting heated at one point, like where
lots of points.
Well, I also liked how he had his briefing book sitting there and didn't seem to be, like, listening to what you're saying. He's just going through the different facts that his team had assembled for him, which in some instances were actually not really facts.
Oh, for sure.
But let's play this part. This is infant mortality rates in that you guys are debating in the context of your argument over abortion. Let's play this.
Maybe you're correct.
That's okay. So as soon as it comes out of the womb, it is living.
That is correct. If it's alive when it comes out of the womb, we don't know, right? A lot of babies die at childbirth. That's why you don't know until
they're
born.
Well, not a lot of babies die at childbirth.
Yeah, a lot.
Very, very
a
low
lot.
Percentage.
Can someone Google that for me, please? Can you please Google how many babies die at childbirth every year?
We have some of the lowest childbirth mortality rates in the world, thankfully.
No, we do not. We have some of the highest. We have some of the highest. United States infant mortality rate places us 16th among the nations of the world.
How many nations
Thousands
are there?
Thousands of infants die each year because of inadequate medical care that you often vote against
are
and
there?
Don't support.
I'm not elected and, official.
But you support things and you have the influence of millions. You don't have a vote? Are you suppressing your own vote now too, or just others?
Are you saying that I vote in Congress?
I'm saying that you vote in elections and you decide who goes to Congress, do you not? And do you not support bills or not support bills based on your massive influence?
I know you're getting really
also,
worked up.
No, I'm not.
So let me
also,
ask you a question.
Also, we rank 33 out of 36 in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development Nations, OECD nations, ranked by U.S. News and World Report for prenatal and early childhood care that you often do not support. In fact, recently, when Biden suggested just $225 billion to support children more in the early years of their lives, you went against it and said oh, capping it while theoretically, you paid empty lip service to it and said, well, theoretically, it's a good idea. $225 billion is so expensive, and it caps the amount they can spend on their children at 7% of income a year. And by doing that, there's no incentives then for them to seek cost-effective care. When you had no problem with Donald Trump spending $8 trillion, giving trillions and trillions of tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, and raising the national debt to $27 trillion.
Can I be
no issue with that? But helping the kids that you care about so much, the babies you care about so much, that you want to force women to give birth to them, and then they can go f- themselves once they're born because you don't give a shit and you vote against it constantly. Bravo! What
honest?
A hill to die on.
I have no idea what the heck you're talking
about. You don't? Well, you went on
okay,
the record.
Okay, let's pause it.
Oh!
I mean, the... he didn't seem to like that part. That's he was sort of like fishing around through his notebook, looking for something to respond to.
He needed some way to like moor himself because he was just getting a little bit discombobulated, I think.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I think it's amazing how these supposed America First people always want America to be just number one. Number two will not do. Except when it comes to the thing that they're enforcing, and then 16th is totally fine. How many countries are there, Ben? There's plenty of third world countries we could compete with. Compared to those places, we're doing fine with babies dying that we're forcing to be born. It's an insane logical inconsistency, but they don't care about that because, lucky for them, their followers don't have the critical faculties to see these inconsistencies. They just go on the feeling of the vibe of what he's of the hateful rhetoric he's putting out there.
I mean, to be fair, I have seen a couple of rallies with the USA chants and we're number 16. just to be fair about that.
They're willing to throw our country really way down the list of priorities as soon as it has a chance to own a lib. I mean, if you remember the people at Trump's rallies wearing shirts that saying, I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat. Instantly, even our adversaries, they would much rather be on the side of our longtime, like, caricaturized adversaries. I mean, from the Rocky movies on, they'd rather be on that team than be on the team that's fighting for the people that they actually are. Much more represented in their way of life is the Democrats fighting for the guys that are not the uber wealthy, but the guy with the t-shirt voting, rallying for I guess, turning on our country is totally fine.
Well, the thing that they may not count some of those statistics in the infant mortality rates or doesn't register in their minds because often babies that die at a disproportionate rate are either black or non-white and they are poor. So for them, it's like, well, you know, maybe not something that they necessarily think about too often.
Yeah, that was another amazing part in the debate is Charlie, he had all these moments that he thought were going to be gotcha moments against me that I think I quickly flipped because I was very prepared and I have, I think, just kindness and care on my side, which certainly helps. He reads a statistic of the number of black potential babies that are aborted every year and he says, are you okay with this? See, I want more black babies, Ben, and you want less. And I go, I want the exact number of black babies that the black community itself wants to have. Who are you? Charlie Kirk gets to decide how many black babies there should be? It's just an insane level of hubris and pompousness to even have that opinion, let alone speak it in words.
He has a finely tuned baby ratio that he wants
That's right.
to implement.
Well, that moment struck me, too, because I think, you know, I'm curious as to what you thought that Charlie Kirk, you know, I mean, and look, you know, I participate in debates like this and they're rarely, well, maybe never. I mean, these type of debates, never about convincing the other person, right? It is about how you want your audience and the person you're debating's audience you know, what you want to achieve with those people. And certainly from Charlie Kirk's perspective, the idea of being able to say to his people, you're not only right in your feelings about abortion, but you're actually anti-racist by being anti-abortion. I mean, that is, that is something that really is like almost like a currency for the people who look at at Charlie Kirk. Like any opportunity for me to say like I'm protecting black people in some way has some value. What else do you think his agenda was in this? Like, were there moments where you're debating where he's like, okay, yeah, this is a meme, this is a narrative that he wants people to walk away with?
I think that he just wanted an opportunity, and maybe that's his goal with the whole debate series he's doing, is just to have a chance to reinforce the exact talking points that he's been feeding people for a long time. And I think, I mean, I don't want to call myself what he thought would be an easy target. He's offered a lot of people. He offered famously Eric Swalwell to do the same debate, and instead of replying to the DM that Kirk slid into, Swalwell blasted the DM and said, I won't go debate an insurrectionist who makes my kids unsafe by voting against school shooting laws to protect our kids. He got the exact same copied and pasted DM, and I said yes and said it to his face and even called him out on being an insurrectionist at the end. I think that he, and by the way, that's a clip that he certainly cut out of his broadcast of it, but I just think he wanted a chance to own me in front of his people, and he didn't know what to do when that wasn't the case. You know, I take it very seriously because I'm going there speaking on behalf of women, which I've not been sanctioned to do, so I at least wanted to do them proud as I could. So I studied very hard for this. I met with Narrell. I was advised by a friend at Planned Parenthood. I wanted to make sure that I really knew what I was talking about when I went in there and was at least presenting the opinions that I think would make these groups that this issue affects most proud. And I don't think he expected it. I think it's very clear, like you said, with his notebook, that he just constantly wanted to move on to his next talking point, because for another example, in addition to wanting to dictate for the black community what they do, he never ever speaks about the mother. He never speaks about the effect on the human being that is then being forced to bring this child into the world and then raise it for 18 plus years. And so I said, look how you never focus on the mother. You clearly don't care at all about the mother. And he literally goes, oh, I do. I care about the mother so much that I want to talk about this. And then change topics to adoption and didn't say a word about the mother. Literally, almost like rotely in his brain, when just kind of spewing out in between words, he showed his lack of care. I care so much, let's change topics.
He may have been a little bit cocky. Oh, go ahead, Matt.
He said, I care so much that we support cops, the border, and charter schools.
Yes. That's his big plan.
This is a little bit off topic, but you mentioned, like, you know, he cut something out of his broadcast. I mean, we're going to play that clip. How did you, what were the terms? Were you able to go in and say, like, I'm not doing this unless I get my own live feed? Is that it?
Oh, yes. I negotiated this pretty heavily before I went in there, because I'm pretty familiar with, you know, what they can do and what his plan might be to, with multiple cameras, to edit it and make me look bad. So I negotiated that they could not cut any content out. They could just trim a little bit of fat for time, which they didn't even do because I didn't give them any fat. I had final cut approval before they released it, and I was able to bring my own camera and shoot it and had the right to release my own footage.
Oh, smart.
As well. Nice. So I was able to make sure that they weren't able to mess with me at all.
Did you guys address, I mean, you say the mother, but like there was no addressing of, like, okay, from a practical matter, how many mothers and doctors would you put into jail? Presumably, if he's talking, like, I can't remember the figure that he said of 30 million, let's play this clip. Let's play this clip where he talks about this Holocaust that has taken place. This, again, is another one of those things where his supporters can feel like they are, you know, it's a never forget moment for them. They're going to remember the Holocaust. They're just going to remember the other Holocaust too, that they have dubbed the Holocaust. But here is Kirk saying,
"You were in the womb." Uh-huh. What does it say in Leviticus about unborn children?
Oh, wow! Somebody wrote that I knew you before you're in the womb.
Yes, somebody called Jeremiah, a minor character in the Bible.
The Bible's beautiful, but it's allegories. So if you're going to take the specific words and say it's some kind of scientific book, it's not a scientific book. It's a good moral guide.
No, it's the word of God, Ben.
In your opinion. But you can't enforce your religious opinion on the world. That's why we,
well,
on the
I'm
country
not,
especially.
I've been making secular arguments.
Sure.
So if you, I'm just asking, as someone who says you were offended by the Holocaust, where millions of Jews were killed, why are you seemingly indifferent with the millions of Americans that are being killed?
Because they're not Americans. You have to be born on U.S. soil to be an American. Again, you prove my point.
No,
thank you.
Human beings.
The definition of an American is being born on U.S. soil. Born.
So
born or naturalized.
Let me ask you,
are killed every year.
Let me ask
through
you a
abortion.
Question.
Thank you. Another point.
The Black Panthers.
In my column, love
the
it.
Black Panthers said, which I disagree with the Black Panthers a lot, but they said that abortion is a black genocide on the community.
Good for them.
Are they wrong?
Yeah, they're of course wrong.
I wonder how many times Charlie Kirk cites the Black Panthers as a guiding light for what we should be doing in the context of American politics.
Grasping at straws at that point. He's like, listen, a group I disagree with and hate very much. They once said that didn't work. All right.
I also think it was pretty interesting that, I mean, it was funny to watch Charlie's face when you were talking about the Bible being an allegory, because, you know, this is what this is. I mean, ultimately, it is a this is a religious edict, right? I mean, this is and that is they attempt to obscure that. Charlie Kirk said himself right there, like, I'm making secular arguments. But we all know at the end of the day, it is because their interpretation of a book that they believe is the word of God is what drives this. And I think they want to obscure that because I think that is the least effective stance they have for anybody who is not a fundamentalist religious person. I mean, I think that's just the bottom line.
Absolutely. And not just that. I then brought up the point, if we're going to be influenced by our religions, the whole point is that you can't, I touched on it there, but we got into it more in depth, is that you can't choose which religion that will be. I'm a Jewish person, and the Jewish religion tends to much more favor in its teachings the wishes of the mother, and that life doesn't begin until the first breath. And then he tried to correct me about what my own religion says, which is amazing. Charlie Kirk knows all the things, all the religions, but it just always shows how there's no consistency and it doesn't truly actually come, I don't even think, from a religious belief. It's just, that's just the origin of where they get the idea, really, and I called him out on this too. Really, this is just a wedge issue that they use to gain more followers and to keep us separated. In the pre-Roe versus Wade times, the big issue that they used in this way to get emotional response from people and to keep communities of color down and to keep their followers on an emotional hook was segregation. The Republican Party then was pro-segregation. And when the country shifted off of that topic and that became obvious that that was no longer morally acceptable to the vast majority of people, they then, after Roe v. Wade, shifted and decided to make abortion that major emotional wedge issue that conveniently gets to keep communities of color down, keep women down, tell them what to do with their own bodies, while at the same time, my dog just walked in, while at the same time also not, also just manipulating people into continuing to be latched onto their every word, because that's a great way to play to people's emotions and not actually care about the people. You actually said a minute ago, too, he said about how many mothers would he want to be in jail and how many doctors. So that was an interesting point, too, that he never responded to. And this is the one of the few points I really couldn't pin him down on because he just kept moving on. But he keeps saying that abortionists should be in jail and they're murderers. And I said, do you have any friends that have had abortions, Charlie? And he goes, yes, I do. And I pray for them. And I'm like, so why are you friends with murderers, Charlie? And he goes, no, because the woman always is manipulated and is not given the real facts and isn't shown ultrasounds. I'm like, never? She's never shown an ultrasound? A woman has never made a decision for an abortion just because she can't afford a baby or isn't ready. It's never happened. And he goes, look, I feel bad for them, but the abortionists are the ones that should be in jail. And I said, Charlie, if you hire a hitman to kill somebody else, are you not a murderer? And he wouldn't answer. I asked him that 5 times. If you hire a hitman, are you not also guilty of murder? And he wouldn't answer because there's no logical consistency.
Well, they can't maintain that logical consistency because they know that at that point, what's going to happen is that the American public is going to understand. It turns the focus back onto the mothers. For him, for Charlie Kirk to make those statements that there are millions upon millions upon millions of American women who do not have the capacity to know what they're doing in this instance, that they're complete dupes in this regard. I mean, according to Charlie Kirk, I don't know what else. If you as a person do not know what you're doing when you decide to not be carry a pregnancy to term, I wonder what you are capable of knowing. I mean, honestly, this is a pretty big deal for people, and particularly for women. It is, I wonder under Charlie Kirk's rubric, are women? Are they able to how are they able to dress themselves? I mean, how are they able to do any of these things?
I'm not able to. I have to have some help in the morning. So, yeah, I mean,
Emma just sort of text me, what are you wearing today?
Mm. Yes.
And then she bases her
one leg at a time. You get the clothes on and somebody hopefully drives you to work.
Yeah.
All right. Exactly. Well, hopefully let's play this last moment, because in the last seconds of the debate, you mentioned something to Charlie Kirk that he did not include on his broadcast, but you did on yours.
You can't infringe on someone's freedom to ask them to wear a mask because it might not spit deadly virus into their face. That's too much of an impingement on freedom for you. But you're okay with rolling back reproductive freedom. You're okay with rolling back voting access in this country. You're okay with broadly undermining our democracy by backing an insurrection literally to overthrow the election of our nation that you supported. I mean, Turning Points literally funded Trump's Jan 6 rally.
So, Ben, I have a question.
That led to an insurrection attempt on our government and the death of many people, including police officers that you claim to love and care for. How do you reconcile being anti-freedom on all of those things and claiming you are pro-freedom?
So, Ben, I have a question. Which one of us
was anti-democracy?
Ben, I have a question. Which one of us was arrested at the Capitol before?
I was.
So you're an insurrectionist?
Oh, no. I didn't break into the building and kill people.
Wait, were you arrested?
Yeah,
Where was I on January 6th?
You were doing a podcast in which you said, I'm getting 500 emails a minute of people saying, we want civil war, ginning that up.
You were arrested at the Capitol.
Not that day.
And I was in Phoenix, Arizona.
And you also sent busloads of people to the Capitol on Jan 6.
How do you justify being an insurrectionist?
You sent people to the Capitol on Jan 6 for the insurrection.
You really should get better research.
Are you not... Hold on.
Our students never got near the Capitol.
None of them. None of them.
They were actually at the... They were at the Ellipse.
And none of them
miles
walked.
Away.
None of them walked
but
into the Capitol.
But you, as an insurrectionist who were arrested at the Capitol...
Zero... No.
Because you are a threat to democracy.
I peacefully protested and told the Capitol Police I would be protesting.
2 years earlier.
It was respectful terrorist. And it was civil disobedience.
I did not know that you were a domestic terrorist.
So you do take blame for the insurrection that happened on Jan 6?
I take no blame. That's slanderous and wrong.
Why do you take no blame for it? You sent buses of people there.
To the Ellipse that got nowhere near the Capitol. You're the insurrectionist.
But that day that you ginned
that
up.
That is libelous and slanderous, and you know it.
That day that you
so what's the final question you have
it.
Here?
That day that you ginned up.
I ginned up nothing.
That day that you ginned up.
Lie. You're the only one that got arrested.
You said you were sending patriots to fight.
I said
Trump.
Nothing like that. That
yes, is, you did.
You've never said.
Is sending buses ginning up?
And you said they want
Listen,
a civil war.
This is so typical
you
of the left.
A civil war.
Where you come in here, where you yourself have been arrested at the Capitol,
peaceful,
and you try to say
protesting.
That I am something
that's
that
different.
Not. You are a domestic terrorist,
Wait, okay.
and a failed presidential candidate no one's ever heard of.
So you're
and
not,
you have the balls to come in here and try to call me that?
So
no,
you're not
let, you're,
so you're not responsible for it?
Let me come.
I'm just asking that. That's my last question.
Not even
you're
close.
You're not responsible
but you
for what happened on
have
Jan
actually
6?
Been arrested on the Capitol.
Okay,
let me finish and say this.
Wait,
this right here is exactly why we're not going to come together as a nation or this.
No.
You dishonestly come in here with poorly researched talking points where I was 2,000 miles away
from
Phoenix, Arizona that day.
You can't incite a mob from a distance?
Let me be very clear. You're the one that's actually been arrested before.
Yeah.
I have not, nor
peaceful
students,
protests.
And they got nowhere near.
None of them
and
did.
Let me
okay.
just let me just finish by saying
wait.
This. You're done. Let me
finish
by saying
here, wait.
This is exactly
I promise,
why
here's my
no
last
one
sentence.
Trusts half the country.
I promise.
Because
here's
they dishonestly
sentence.
Lie Charlie. About this and they think they got one.
But this is all cut, right? This is not on his.
So this was on. He ends it right after this.
He's been arrested.
And then when he gets up, he didn't air any of this.
Thank you so much for a great debate. Thank you guys so much.
I promise you my last sentence.
This all is not on from here.
Thank you.
If you're not responsible for what happened on Jan 6, is that because unintended consequences happened that you didn't anticipate?
I hope that
kind of like mothers that have an unintended pregnancy, they didn't anticipate. So if you want to be cut some slack for Jan 6, maybe you could cut women some slack.
Thank you.
Who unintendedly get pregnant. Thank you. Does that sound like a deal?
You're the domestic terrorist.
I was peaceful protesting, my friend.
Thank you. Domestic terrorist.
You ginned up an insurrection on our country.
That's so fun. That's good.
Oh, he was big mad. He was real mad there. You got it.
I mean, he also must have anticipated the question, right? And because that's why he did his research on your protest activities.
Yes, which, just to clarify, that's the one thing I regret, that I was so caught off guard by that. I didn't make very clear. It was literally in 2019 during my presidential campaign in a planned act of civil disobedience that I went with Represent Us as part of a 900-mile march or 700 miles from Atlanta to D.C. that Ronaldo Pearson did, and I joined for the last mile, and we told the Capitol Police we were protesting corruption in government and trying to get lobbyist money out and trying to stop voter suppression, and we told the cops, and we sat in, and they said, if you don't stand up, you'll be arrested, and we did that. We didn't stand up, and we got arrested, and it was coordinated with the police.
Peaceful civil disobedience. I mean, people understand the difference between that. Well, listen, Ben.
And so let me just say quickly, so then he tries to hover over me and intimidate me, and I think the point at the end there, even though it's a little bit of a mixed message, is, I think, so good, because if you're going to literally carelessly support an overthrow of an election, an overthrow of our government, and not take responsibility for so closely, if not directly, encouraging these people to storm the Capitol building, to not certify an election, and you are not responsible for that unintended consequence, as you claim, it just doesn't make sense for such a large thing to say you have no blame. But for an everyday thing that happens millions of times a year, somebody gets pregnant by accident, to not understand that maybe you should be able to have a way out of that situation if you're not ready for it. It's always a sad instance when an abortion happens. It's not done lightly, but it's something that the woman should be able to choose between herself and her doctor. And that should be, I think, pretty darn clear.
Yeah, I mean, I just on that last point, like, I just got to say, from my perspective, like, it isn't always a sad instance on an abortion. I mean, nobody likes to go to the doctor. I don't. But I don't think it's in many respects any sadder than getting your appendix out in certain instances. I mean, for some people, I have no doubt that it is, that it can be, a hard decision to make and, but one of timing, but I don't know that it's always necessarily sad. Frankly, I know a lot of people who have had abortions and, to the extent that they were sad about it, it was, there's been a whole host of things in their life that they're actually genuinely sad about, and that's not generally one of them. But
people get sad about a lot of stuff. You get sad about TV show stuff. I still miss my appendix, and I write letters to it, but that's me, you know.
There you go. Ben, what? Where can people find you, find your show, or what would you like to plug?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. It's been really cool to be on this show. You guys do amazing work. You can follow me at Ben Glebe on all social media, very active on Twitter and Instagram. I have a show that just dropped yesterday on Disney Plus called Just Beyond. I'm an actor in that show. I play a ghost in episode 6. My game show Idiot Test is on Game Show Network on the weekends and Pluto TV. You can watch season 1 of it there. And I have a virtual comedy club I created during the pandemic so people can actually have live entertainment from the safety of their own home. Live audience, live laughter. You see and hear everybody. It's called NowhereComedyClub.com, NowhereComedyClub.com for tickets to all the shows, other comedians, not just me. And I do a weekly show there called Glebe Off the Top, Crowdwork and Improvised Madness, where you're part of our community. We elect a mayor, and I just go nuts and improvise with you and play characters. And it's really fun. You can get tickets to all of that at NowhereComedyClub.com or my website, BenGlebe.com.
Busy.
Awesome.
Busy.
Very busy.
Appreciate it, Ben. Thanks for coming on.
It's totally my pleasure. Oh, sorry. Well, it's a million plugs. I'm sorry. But also have an in-person tour. I'm coming soon to Phoenix and Dallas and Valencia this weekend and Vancouver. So if you want to come see me in person, also BenGlebe.com for my Descent into Madness tour. That was too many plugs. I'm sorry.
No, I
like them all. Appreciate it. All right. Thanks again, Ben. Yes,
my pleasure.
Congratulations, too. Appreciate the work you did there with Charlie Kirk.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
All right, folks. Listen, we're going to take a break, but we'll do a freebie. We'll do be a freebie Friday, but we both need a break for a second. Before we take that break, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show pop. Oh, wait a second. Monday, we're going to have an announcement. that is, I think is going to be exciting to a lot of people. That's about all I'm going to do. Let me tease it a little bit more. Wilbur. Okay. That's all I'm given. Just that's it. That's part of that's a clue about what the announcement will be on Monday regarding this program. Just the word Wilbur.
It's not Wilbur Ross.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Maybe we have a new member of the team.
New producer.
Commerce Secretary of the United States. That's a guy who seems to know how to like generate money for himself, but maybe he could do it for a podcast. That could be it. It could be that. Could be. Could be. All I'm saying could be. But a reminder in the meantime, before we've got to pay Wilbur Ross's salary. And so you can help this show survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get more content in the fun half. We got a lot of things in store for us this year, and you can help us execute those things perfectly. Also, check out Nomi's show, youtube.com, the Nomiki show. You can find it on youtube.com at / the Nomiki show. And she is in Scotland interviewing people, getting ready for the big climate summit there. You should check that out. Really fascinating. And Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, people should check out the most recent Left Reckoning episode on Wednesday on the YouTube channel. We talked about the Great Resignation and the strike wave with Maximilian Alvarez of Working People Podcast, who actually had a couple of the IATSE workers we had on his show himself. And this weekend for Left Reckoning patrons, David Griscom and I are going to be talking about the first essay in George Orwell's Lion and the Unicorn, England, Your England, which was written during the Blitz. And he says basically the World War II proved that laissez-faire capitalism just doesn't work. And we need to move on to something else and do a socialist movement to overthrow capitalism. So that will be for patrons this weekend, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right. So we're going to do a Freebie Friday, but we are going to play the song here so that we can both take a little bit of a break. All right. Be right back.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
African and the alpha males are black, 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 and the Africans are black, 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 black.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are black, black. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are black, black.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
back.
We are back. Boy, I'll tell you something. Everybody's accusing me of being a boomer on the IMs because of the Wilbur thing. And it's such projection. Because they're all talking about Mr. Ed. And it's not like when I was a kid, I didn't watch Mr. Ed. That was before my time. I was aware of it.
You guys got it. We are incorporating a live horse into the studio.
A talking horse.
I want a ride horse.
Yeah, the horse will talk, and we're still figuring out the technology. But just so the vegan callers know, it will involve a lot of animal cruelty. So...
We're planning on that.
Just being up front.
That's good that you're being frank up front about that.
Yeah,
we're doing to the talking horse. That we're bringing
transparency in. Is the name of the game.
So let's just I want to play these two clips. I know that you guys talked about John Deere yesterday. There is also we should say that from. Labor notes. Maybe we can. I don't know if you guys have this this tweet thread that I don't think you do from John Furman at Labor
Jonah.
Notes. Jonah Furman at Labor Notes, and he wrote. This was, I guess, 2 days ago. The John Deere strike breakers, and he puts that in quote. Are currently 650 salary employees pulled from engineering and management positions across Deere. Note, I say strike breakers in quote, because I can guarantee that with our lack of skill in numbers, we will not be breaking the strike. This is, I think, and then he further quotes, to my knowledge, most of us, and this is obviously one of the white collar, essentially salaried employees saying, most of us will be allocated to the Milan Parts Center. Deere spent an enormous amount of time, money, and effort trying to get us all trained, but not many of us are really ready for this. We'll be working 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, with days and night shifts. In my position, I'm not looking forward to this. I think the wage employees deserve a lot more than they are offered, and I absolutely support them striking. And what's going to happen is you are going to get more sympathy. You're going to get more sympathy, for the workers, on these assembly lines, et cetera, the factory floor, because,
they're going to see how hard their job is. Yeah.
Here's an example. Furman posted, go back, play this. This is a 8 a.m. It was a 9/11 call that...
This is a screenshot. We can go back to the video.
Oh, okay. Well, we don't need to. I mean, the idea was that, I mean, there was an ambulance that was sent over there. Presumably somebody may have hurt themselves on this floor because they weren't, you know, properly trained. Right. And the other thing, and I think I mentioned this the other day. I'm not sure if I did or not. You know, in the morning I listened to radio to hear how the AP news breaks at the bottom and the top of the hour are covering... just the day's news. I'm just curious. And I heard a couple, this is actually, I guess is yesterday. I heard, and I listened to radio for part of the day. I heard the AP come on a couple of times and say that the strikers were offered 5% and another group of strikers were offered 6% raises. And I was like, it's not it's not a great raise, but I guess if the company's really hurting, okay. And only one time out of like maybe the four or five different packages I heard AP report this, they always talked about what the workers were offered. They only one time did they say that John Deere was having record-breaking billions of dollars of profit.
Right.
And I was just like, wow, this really, I mean, you know, that's, it is amazing how these things are framed in the corporate media. Play this clip of John Deere workers striking in Ottumwa, Iowa. You can see them on the picket line. And there's a lot of solidarity, like local people are coming out and bringing restaurants or bringing them food. Check this out.
Let's go, brothers and sisters. Hold that line. UAW 74.
And meanwhile, this is not the only strike that's happening. We have we've talked about this. We have nurses striking in Worcester, Mass. Still in Buffalo. We have healthcare workers striking in on the West Coast as well.
Coal miners and
coal
Alabama
miners
still striking.
About 1,400, I believe, down in Bessemer, I think. It's not Bessemer.
No.
It's,
mm-hmm.
But it's against
Worriamet.
Worriamet
and the Kellogg's workers too. In the
right.
I think four places.
Let's play this clip of Kellogg's workers, and they're in four different factories, I should say, around the country. This is the one in Omaha, Nebraska, and you can see people showing their support.
So that's like that group of bikers not allowing anybody to cross the picket line there.
Yep.
Using the intimidating noise of a motorcycle, which I so despise, for the greater good. So I can get on board with it there.
And, you know, we talked about the 60,000 Yahtzee workers that may go on strike on Monday. And, you're hearing just more and more, you know, one of the things that's happened during this pandemic, and Emma brought this up to the Yahtzee folks that we had on talking about the potential for the strike. During the pandemic, it gave people a chance to step back and sort of say like, hey, wait a second. you know, when you have a moment to reflect, you start to realize like we're getting abused here. And a lot of people made a lot of money during the pandemic, and it needs to be shared with the workers. And it's, I don't know, it's an exciting time in terms of labor in this country. We will see where this goes, because what it feels like is not happening is the increase in strikes is not diminishing the number of strikes.
Yeah.
In other words, like we're starting to see some measure of momentum here in terms of labor using their power to withhold their labor.
Bradley, can you pull up this image I just sent? I'm sorry, I meant to send this earlier, but in the chat. This is a Kellogg's worker later or at some point during protest in Omaha, showing solidarity through torrential rain. Look at that, just standing out there. I mean, that's a power. There are a lot of powerful images that have come out of that, including yesterday, the what we showed the Iowa the Iowa strikers who stopped a freight truck from crossing the picket line as well. But that's a pretty amazing image there.
Folks, if you're in the locality of where strikers are, go down there, bring them a pizza.
Yeah.
Send them some food.
Strike funds there, as well.
Honk the horn.
Do some social media messages.
Yes.
Clap for them. Just show them that there's people in the community that support them. It's very, very helpful.
Right.
All right. Let's turn our attention to Lindsey Graham.
Oh, boy.
Digging deep in the Republican playbook. And you know, we talked to...
Yeah, right. He's once again projecting his tortured psyche onto his politics.
We spoke to Omar. We played that interview today, but about what's going on with the Biden administration's policy in terms of immigration. And, you know, having heard from our friend Ronald Reagan, immigration lawyer, he feels there's a lot of things that the Biden administration could be doing in terms of like unilaterally to ease the issues for immigrants. Omar seemed to be saying that in some ways they're using some of these policies as a way of like attempting to stem the flow of immigrants so that they can fix the mechanisms in which to absorb and integrate them. I don't know what the answer is. Some of these policies, particularly with the Haitian immigrants that we saw, just seem completely reprehensible to me. The Biden administration is being forced by a judge to maybe reinstate the Remain in Mexico policy. But of course, Mexico needs to agree to it before that happens. And who knows how that's being back channeled. But meanwhile, Lindsey Graham on there coming up with a new, this is a new talking point. Because usually when we hear about Republicans complain about immigration, they want to pretend it's like, you know, we don't want people coming in on the dole. We don't want to, you know, social benefits going to these immigrants and unskilled labor taking away jobs from Americans. And, you know, they're going to go right on to welfare. Here's Lindsey Graham coming up with a new tack. They're bringing in too much designer goods.
To Arizona, a 1,300% increase in illegal crossings in the Yuma sector in the last few months. Why? We changed the Remain in Mexico policy. Now, what Mayorkas did today, calling off all the raids of worksite, is going to be another incentive for people to come. Because the word is out, you come, you claim asylum, you never leave. The policy choices of Biden are all over the world now. We had 40,000 Brazilians come through the Yuma sector alone, headed for Connecticut, wearing designer clothes and Gucci bags. This is not economic migration anymore. People see an open America. They've taken advantage of us, and it won't be long before a terrorist gets in this crowd.
Unrelated question.
Wait a second. Wait, what? Yeah, is there a mixed up a bunch of talking points? You've got Gucci wearing Brazilians headed to Connecticut to what? What exactly are they going to? It's not
sounds
about
like a good fucking time.
I mean, I'm not quite clear. So are they going to Connecticut to presumably buy more Gucci goods at the mall?
The point is that they're lying about their asylum status. They're rich and they're able to afford lots of designer bags that Lindsey Graham would love to have, but he's not able to purchase them for a variety of reasons. But
honestly, like, what is this supposed to communicate? Like, these Brazilians are coming
into Connecticut?
They're
rich and they don't need asylum. And but why
Connecticut?
They're cozy. Yeah, I don't know why Connecticut. Because it's supposed to be a suburbia 101. I don't know.
But I mean, that's
like, I don't understand the complaint here. It's like, they're going to go there and they're going to take up all the lake houses for Americans. I mean, what's what? Wait, what?
Also, aren't you, you know,
oh my gosh.
I thought the policy was that you're supposed to let the blue states deal with this like mass illegal migration. Shouldn't they be happy?
This is the last thing that Connecticut College needs after everything that they're going through.
Exactly. They're going up there to you've got these Brazilians coming in with their Gucci bags to protest the Connecticut College's lockdown policies on COVID. I mean, what's also
they have karaoke
like
machines,
and then he also sort of says like there's terrorists amongst them, like in the I'm going, I'm a terrorist. I'm going to America disguised as a wealthy Brazilian who's going to be living in Connecticut. I mean, like, are these people going to like New Haven? Are they going to the beaches? Are they going to the lake houses in Connecticut? I mean,
he's got it wrong. The terrorists wear Balmain.
I just think there's, I don't know. I would not be surprised if some weird thing about Brazil and Lindsey Graham comes out, like, because what, like, what?
Yeah, there's, it's so bizarre.
It's a little bizarre, too specific. Yeah.
We have wealthy people sneaking in across the border. You do? Really?
I mean,
okay, tax them.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. Like, good. Let's make them pay a big fee.
Like luxury tax. Let's get it going.
He heard some anecdote about like the fact that one of the migrants coming across the border was wearing a Gucci hat or had a Louis Vuitton bag. And so he extrapolates that widely. I don't know if he's ever been to an area like, I don't know, Canal Street. There are a lot of ways to buy designer clothes or fake designer clothes of the pier as such. But, so but it doesn't even necessarily is, correlate but, to like the wealth but, of the migrant. I know he's making it up and it's immaterial. But
that doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, I mean, why would you, what is the talking point supposed to convey to people that
that's what I'm saying, that they're on the
Brazilians.
Take.
But the thing is like the reason the on the take thing doesn't make sense is because like the whole, like Tucker's messaging how dirty and diseased they are.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's true. I guess it's a different flavor. Maybe he's trying to carve out his own little constituency versus Tucker. They're wealthy and they don't deserve to be here, as opposed to they're dirty and then they're ruining everything.
I guess. I mean, it's just
they're dirty and he's mad. Their designer clothes are dirty. You should wash that. It's nice.
If you get rid of the zero sum sort of like anxiety about, you know, material and resources and stuff like that, like I feel like you lose a lot of the
exactly. They're going to come here. These are people who are coming here, and they're going to be paying in the top income tax bracket.
They come here wearing blue de Chanel.
Exactly. It's just a very bizarre, talking point. And like, is there like I just found that whole thing just very, very odd. But yeah, have fun.
Watch that story.
Meanwhile, they have dug Michael Savage up. He's back.
Right.
I mean, he's been on radio for a long time. If you're not familiar with Michael Savage, Michael Savage had an MSNBC show, actually, at the beginning of the early aughts. I don't know if you knew that, Emma.
Seems like an awesome choice by them.
He is a rabid right-winger who Janine Garofalo and I, when we used to have our program, she used to say he saw Allen Ginsberg naked one too many times. I think it was talking about Michael Savage, because he was one of those guys who was, I think, like a lefty in the, you know, in the 60s. But here is, he is on Newsmax with Newsmax's Steve Cortez.
Remember who he is. He's a, there are words I
Ozzy,
can't
I'm
use
sorry.
On this
we
TV
just gotta
show
say, about- he's talking about George Soros here. And he tried go, he wades into some medieval era anti-Semitism.
Remember who he is. He's a, there are words I can't use on this TV show about this man who I think is the devil incarnate. By the way, I think he's the devil incarnate. But you ask, why would a multi-billionaire do a thing like this to a country that welcomed him after the Holocaust when he fled the Nazis? Let's not forget that. What is he doing?
Right.
Is he insane? There's always a profit motive with a person, if you want to call him that, like this.
Oh.
Why does he do it? To cause and sow disorder, to destroy the middle class. There's always money to be made somehow. Perhaps he shorted Walgreens stock. Do I know? We don't know what this man does. Remember what he did? He shorted the English pound, made $1 billion, almost drove England into bankruptcy. He shorted the Indonesian currency, almost drove Indonesia into bankruptcy. Why does this man... why is he permitted to do things like this to the city? It's not, why does he do it? I don't know how crazy people, Stephen, exactly. I don't know how crazy people think. What does he benefit by walking out of his park?
I'm glad you pointed out, by the way, that this country welcomed him in. I mean, talk about ingratitude. Not only did we welcome him, but we provided him through our capitalist system with the opportunity to become unimaginably wealthy. And he pays us back by literally destroying, again, not his community, because his peers are fine, by destroying the communities of middle and working and lower class people who don't have alternatives, who don't have private security, who don't travel on private jets, the kinds of people who have to deal with the consequences of his actions. And it's just reprehensible. You know, think of how much evil we would have saved if we had deported this guy a long time ago rather than giving him citizenship in the United States.
You know what's fascinating about this to me is that they're so close to getting the idea that there could be something wrong with our system.
Yeah, but they just fall back on like just casual, but also very throwback anti-Semitism there, right? Like basically likening him to the devil and saying he's not even human. Might want to reevaluate.
Well, I also just think that like he sounds like he's a capitalist. And I mean,
what's his name in Bezos or whoever?
Right, exactly. Like maybe there's a problem with the system. It's not like, listen, if we let you into the country, you got to be grateful and you know, would do good things for us.
No, in fact, he came into the country and he was more American than you could possibly be. He exploited this capitalist system and he made himself incredibly wealthy and he bought off our politicians. I mean, that's part of what Soros does, right? Not saying that I'm going to wade into the waters that they choose to. The left obviously has a critique about systemic corruption that involves Soros, but you could make a systemic argument and not do just that. There's nothing more American than what Soros is doing right now with his money.
Exactly.
That's exactly what he...
Maybe you shouldn't be allowed to short currencies that would bankrupt the country. How about that for an idea?
I found out something funny about Savage when researching Mark Levin. Mark Levin was apparently just some Republican operative guy, but he started calling in a lot during the Bill Clinton sort of impeachment stuff, but for free for Hannity. So he's basically a free contributor. But then Hannity went on break and Levin started kicking Savage's ass in the ratings. And he's been made ever since then.
Yep. Levin was actually, I think, in Reagan's DOJ. Right. I don't know how prominent of a role he had, but. Savage is an interesting guy, and Newsmax is probably where he belongs, but it is so close. They were so close to going like, hey, maybe there's a problem with the system that allows this. No, it's just that we can't allow evil people
Should we let capitalists do it, whatever they want? Or I guess we should just figure out which ones are going to be evil somehow.
Right, right. Yeah, let's pick out the evil test. Yeah, but that's always the right wing's when they stumble upon some kind of critique in that way. It's just this one bad individual, and it's usually for racist or bigoted reasons. But the system itself is working phenomenally. So we'll scapegoat this person, gin up our racist base, and that suits the interests of keeping things as they are.
Lastly, let's tune in to see what Dr. Steven Crowder believes is an assessment of the mental health of folks who are transgender.
But this shows that, you know, there are people who are seriously born with this issue of becoming transgender, where I do think they're more sensitive, more female, whatever it may be. And now it shows how many people are faking it and just attacking people.
We don't know what percentage of them are faking it versus.
No, we don't.
There's also a lot of these
there's
people.
There's clearly an example that it's happening.
It absolutely has happened. Unfortunately, we also have examples of people who are long-time transgenders who lived as such, and they're also much more likely to commit sex crime.
It seems like both are a real problem, and it would behoove us to study that and try to figure
Look,
it out.
Look, is anyone
people.
Surprised when it's a 42% attempted suicide rate? You don't have that anywhere else in the demographic. That would suggest some kind of mental proclivity toward extreme behavior, and I don't
Pause
think
it.
It's helping
I'm sorry.
People.
Yeah. Or it's your contributions and people like you to stigmatizing said people and making it seem like there's something wrong with them, with trans people, that might be contributing to their desire to not live in a world, at least temporarily, that treats them in such a way. And we saw this for a while with LGBT or gay and lesbian youth. Those rates are higher as well. And so if you're queer or if you're trans or if you're gay or if you're lesbian, it's because of the environment created by people like Steven Crowder actively and gleefully, because he doesn't want to look at his own sexuality, let's be real, like, and deflect, and we'll make this toxic for you and then blame you for having a reaction to the society that I am actively helping foster.
This is a guy who wants to, quote, normalize gun carrying. So he wears a holster on his show every day with a gun strapped onto him. I'm sure it provides, you know, some other sort of emotional benefits for him. Mm. I'm sure it's not, you know, some type of you know, male substitute or just a way of proving to his dad that he's actually, you know, a tough guy. But he understands the concept of normalizing and destigmatizing. In this instance, it's behavior. It's carrying a gun that could kill people. That's actually designed to kill people. I mean, let's be honest. That's what it's for, to kill people. You don't carry around a gun because you want to do target practice at whatever time you are. You carry it around because you feel like at one point you may have a reason to kill somebody. And so he definitely understands the concept of stigmatizing people and it having an impact. Mm. Is there any more to this lunacy?
I just want to say one thing. Like we should study this. We literally banned studying the effects of guns in this country, right. Congressionally.
Yes.
Is there more? Oh yeah.
Surprise when it's a 42% attempted suicide rate. You don't have that anywhere else in the demographic. That would suggest some kind of mental proclivity toward extreme behavior, and I don't think it's helping people to simply enable it. I don't want 42% of transgenders, 41%, depending on the stat you use. It's right in there. It's very rare that you get multiple studies that come in that 41, 42%. Like, they're all like within a point of each other, pre-op and post-op. I don't want nearly half of all transgenders to attempt suicide. I want that to be lower. Guess what doesn't work? You saying, you're all good. You're a woman. It doesn't help. It makes it worse. And it makes it potentially slightly worse. People are afraid to study it, but we know at least one percentage worse, which really is statistically insignificant, if you go through the surgery. Let me guess. This is an inference now. That's the data. The inference is, I would imagine that if you have a transgender individual, 41%, 42% likely to commit suicide, okay, goes through transition where you have a man, put him on estrogen, which, by the way, we know causes depressive symptoms, cut off his cock, I don't think he comes out ahead. I think when you say you're transgender, and now we're going to give you the surgery, which may make it impossible for you to ever achieve sexual climax again, I'd off myself. I'd be like a Japanese businessman, just plummeting.
Jeez.
It wouldn't even be terrible. Like, you'd just be like, oh, there it goes. That's what you should, like, anytime you see, I'd be like, oh, there goes another guy who cut off his penis.
Well, if your fascination is to some degree with sex, and then you take away the ability to derive pleasure from it, I would imagine that's extremely dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
To yourself.
Just imagining stuff now.
First of all, yes, they're imagining in these studies, like I have not looked up those studies, but I would also imagine that there's some questions about those studies. But even if that's the case, he's just inferring that that this is a function of allowing people who want to be transgender, as if like these people are all going to be much happier if you force them to live a life that is a lie. Now, it may work for some people. Maybe it works for Steven. We don't know. The idea that somehow he's got the answer for these people. And what's also fascinating to me is he doesn't seem to be aware that there's also transgender men.
I'm trying to find the study that he's referring to, because I'm pretty sure Tucker Carlson tried to cite the same study and it's been debunked. And we did the debunking on the show, but only so much we can keep in our brains.
Imagine having a show that you, and let's be honest, folks, if you were really concerned about the suicide rate of transgender people, would you spend any moments on your program mocking, harassing, expressing transphobic comments. Was that really what you would do?
That's what. Yeah.
Dressing up like a woman.
Weird. Carter dressed up like a woman and threw weights around the Planet Fitness until he got kicked out because he was trying to lower the suicide rate of trans people.
Yeah, he was trying to normalize it by being in women's clothes.
I really don't think he does care. In fact, I would probably argue the opposite.
I think if that went up higher, he'd be like, "Oh, good validation."
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. The gym stunt was just an excuse for him to dress up that way, and you know, that's his cross to bear, I guess.
All right, let's do some IMs. Wrap it up for the week. Left hand stranger.
Damn. What? I didn't even realize what time it was.
Yeah. Left hand stranger. Is one of the melodies in the intro taken from the song "The Girl from Ipanema"? I don't think so.
The thing where it goes deep, be dee, dee, deep, deep, beep, beep.
Okay. Yeah,
it sounds a little bit like it.
Goopak, I think Sinema's pissed because if both bills were passed together, she would miss out on the praise for putting together a bipartisan bill. Work it out that she gets a 2-week victory tour and then allow her to be the one to save the reconciliation bill. She seems narcissistic in that way. Yeah, I find that hard to believe. Sammy missed yesterday on the 5-time award-winning Emma the Vig Vigland Sports Bookie Hour. Says Oliver Wendell, home slice. Anyway, polling data on Kristen Sinema gave me some hope until I realized her obvious backup plan is to use this one term as a springboard into a lucrative lobbying career. I got news for you. She's not getting a lobbying career.
Yeah.
I mean, who would she lobby? Her fellow senators at this point are probably just enraged with her. Yeah. And it's not like she has like some credibility in some type of issue set. She doesn't have like relationships like in, I don't know. What's more likely is maybe that pharma just says, we're going to hire you as a, you know, brand ambassador for $3 million a year for the next 10 years and good job sinking the Medicare. I mean, can you imagine the, like having to rationalize to anybody, why we should not have the government negotiate for prices for prescription drugs for Medicare? I mean, this is not a socialistic a concept. This is, we see this all the time, monopsony even. And this is not even a monopsony. You see buyers negotiate based upon volume all the time. And so this is just blatant trying to carve out and protect big pharma's profits. I don't understand how you could even like look somebody in the face and rationalize this.
Yeah.
We can't do anything to save Medicare $600 billion, $700 billion. I mean, it's unbelievable. Travis from Dallas. Live in a city next to South Lake where the board member stated that teachers must look at both sides of Holocaust. Oh, I read this earlier. Fetal Dolphin Tail. Right-wing goal for education seems to be to make everything history just a thing that happened. No moral judgments can be made about something unless it happened so long ago that it does not affect present day, even though we know it does.
Yeah, Nolan, I think there's some of that, but I also think it's mainly about preserving it as mythology.
Yep. Nolan from the Detroit suburbs. Hey, MR crew, did the New Deal in the 1930s and expansion of the social safety net during the later administrations up to the Johnson administration war on poverty lead to the economic problem during the 70s? I always wonder if that correlation has any merit, which led to the Reagan administration saying the government was the source of economic problems. Well, no. The 40 years of huge expansion of the middle class of one of the six most successful eras of our economy lead to the economic problems of the 70s when we had an oil embargo? No, it did not. It did not. And you know what?
Would you take 40 years of
government expansion and investment in the future, the highway you're driving on, the some of the books and literature and artwork that you consume, the Social Security. I mean, all of these things. Would you take 40 years of that for 5 or 10 years of a bad economy? I mean, obviously, but it's not the case.
Yeah, Andrew Hartman, who has been on the show previously to talk about culture wars, has a review of several books kind of on this topic in the U.S. Intellectual History blog. If you search Andrew Hartman, the new historiographic consensus on the 1970s, I would check that out.
All right, a couple more here, and then we're going to get going. Demian. Ilhan Omar is incredible. Such a joy to listen to. Faye has a cool Godzilla poster there. Damn, Ben handled Charlie like somehow he could see the future. Bravo, Ben. Love when you all talk about these strikes. Remind me how Vaush called Sam a big, beefy union guy. Beefy?
Like how Bobby Big Wheel is big, fat daddy.
Exactly. Salty balls. Oh, shoot. So would you... Would the school district be cool with books that support the 9/11 attacks or say that even happened? Yeah, I'm unbelievable.
But I mean, that is how we teach slavery and Native American displacement in this country, is we teach both sides of it.
Yeah.
Attorney Andrew, as MR's resident Houston sports fan, I wanted to write in to say Beantown, more like Bad Town. Astros in 3. Ooh, boy. See, we'll just see you on Monday.
I mean, collectively, like, fuck the Astros. Yeah, like, come on, agreed.
Ooh. Is she like the Patriots of the MLB?
Who?
I mean, they're like way worse cheaters.
What?
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Who?
The Houston Astros.
The Astros.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Sox.
I defend Belichick on a lot of that stuff. By the way,
fierce deity. As somebody who's never been to Boston's theater district and certainly doesn't know the names of any of the theaters there, I sure am confused by Sam's clue. Fierce deity. Now I know why they call you fierce deity.
Yes, I'm all-knowing and fierce.
Juicy. Wow, America really is a third world country in a Gucci belt. Thanks, Lindsay. Two more. Awakened Joe. Steve Crowder has a problem with people faking being trans, yet he himself fakes being a straight guy? Question mark? You're just asking questions. And the final I am of the day. I really only knew Ben as the host of Idiot Test on GSN from 1 a.m. binges during the summer or studying when there's nothing else I was on. I now know Ben as Charlie Kirk's murderer. He's the equivalent of the Zodiac Killer and Richard Ramirez, as well as a domestic terrorist, of course. Great interviews all around today. Left is best. Emma, Bradley, Matt, great job this week. Folks, we will see you on
Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know? Takes you. Yeah, I know.